a stranger in your town. All your white men's roads lead upward, all the Indians leading down. And the dark seas flow around.
Tribal sovereignty means that, it's sovereign. It's, you've been given sovereignty and you're viewed as a sovereign entity.
Okay.
And therefore, the relationship between the federal government and tribes is one between sovereign entities. Sovereign entities. Sovereign entities. Sovereign.
And good morning. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. And I'm in the studio once again after many months. I don't know, a couple months. How long has it been? With Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
And Jacqueline, for those who you don't know, she substituted me. And thank you so much for doing that for, over a month.
Oh, it was great. I mean, I missed you. So it's really great to be back with you.
And I'm sure people missed you because we didn't have you on last month because it was membership drive. And we got to have famous white authors.
Yeah. I was actually in San Francisco covering the taking down of that statue, that really offensive pioneer statue in San Francisco. Yeah. And I also, they had the whole climate global climate action summit going on.
Well, let's talk about that as we go along. I know that was an obnoxious thing to say, but no, it was a really silly thing to say. But no, I had Chris Hedges on during membership drive. We like to present people who have sold a lot of books and have written new books, and he had a new book out, and so that was a really unique occasion to have.
Wow. I would have liked Hedges to talk on. To him. That would have been nice. Sure.
And he was on alternative radio yesterday, a very powerful talk. On KBOO. So anyway, we have you in the studio here once again, and we have Joel Garcia on the line. I'll introduce you in a second, but we just had Blackfire to open up with Indian Alien, the worst of which were by actually Peter LaFarge, who was actually probably not Native American, but wrote a lot of songs sort of from the point of view of Native Americans back in the 50s and 60s. Anyway, his songwriting is well respected apparently, because Blackfire did a version of that from their CD Silence is a Weapon, and we're hoping to have Clee Benally, the amazing Diné Navajo artist, musician, activist, on the line with us as well to talk about Indigenous Peoples Day, The Legacy of Columbus, Beyond Columbus, as Jacqueline's article that just came out on Truth Out yesterday.
Yep.
Beyond Columbus Day, Changing the Name is Just the First Step. And now let me introduce Joel Garcia, who is an artist and cultural organizer with over 20 years of experience working transnationally with artists across the Americas with a focus on Indigenous perspectives. He's with the Mestli Project in Los Angeles. He served as co-director at Self Help Graphics and Art for many years. And anyway, he can talk about himself. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning.
And I guess we find you in Los Angeles, I imagine.
Yes, yes. I'm born and raised here.
And so you're going to be talking about Indigenous Peoples Day in Los Angeles, but also a statue.
Yeah, could you tell our audience about what's going on there what the city is going to do about the Columbus statue that is still standing?
Sure. So in the middle of downtown, you have a statue that was gifted to the county. It's a statue of Columbus, and more recently, the park where it's located at was redeveloped. And the funny thing is that the whole park itself, whether it was intended or not, was kind of built around the statue, because the statue was there before the park got redeveloped. So since as far back as 92, folks have, you know, done actions to call attention to the removal of that statue. And more, like, throughout the years, it's kind of intensified to the point where a few years ago, I would probably say, like, 4 years ago, it really became a thing where folks every year just, you know, had to protest the presence of it. And as part of Self-Help Graphics work that we do for Day of the Dead, we have partnered with the park to produce a community altar night there. And one of the things that we always try to address somehow was the presence of the statue, because it's, you have all these beautiful altars, you know, honoring the ancestors, but yet there's this presence here of, you know, genocide and all this other stuff. And last year, one of, you know, Puerto Rican artist, who felt that, you know, within the media, within even LA politics, you know, the hurricane had just happened in Puerto Rico, and not much was being done to call attention to that. Yet, here we had, you know, the mobilizing for all these different things through social justice circles, but very, very, very little effort to, you know, to call attention to what's taking place in Puerto Rico. So her and I went to, you know, we thought that that statue should, even within the conversations of Indigenous Peoples Day, felt that it was, that, you know, that Taino people were being invisibilized, and it was very much being centered on a, you know, Northern Native perspective. And so we thought that, like, we needed to do something, you know, to center it back on to the Taino folks who had that direct first contact with Columbus. So as we went out there to try to convert the statue into an altar, we're surrounded by police and security guards. And the ironic thing is that the lead officer on the ground that evening was Puerto Rican. And through that conversation of trying to, like, de-escalate the situation, kind of gotten into speaking about his family. So, you know, at least one person through the process was able to reconnect with their past through, you know, through the presence of this grotesque image, you know, in the middle of a park. And so
that's amazing.
Where things, you know, kind of where things are at now, it's kind of like up in limbo, where the city, the county, and the direct entities that are connected to the statue, like the Arts Commission, had agreed to remove it, but, you know, and had agreed to remove it before Indigenous Peoples Day on Monday, but here it is, it's still standing.
Wow, there was actually an agreement to remove it before, and this was LA's first Indigenous Peoples Day, wasn't it? I mean, last year they voted to change it. And that was a pretty drama-filled city council session. And this was their very first Indigenous Peoples Day, and the Columbus statue was still standing. Did they cover it, or?
They did. Last year, when some of the protests began, they went and they erected like a little fence around it and put some white bag around it. It looked pretty silly. And then this year, they built a black wooden box around it so that folks wouldn't attempt to do anything to it.
Wow.
Essentially protecting the statue from the people.
Huh. And is there a time frame to actually remove it? Have you heard or?
No, there's a LA County Arts Commission meeting coming up next week, which some of us plan to attend, because it definitely feels like that this process is being, one, they've lied to the community because they had agreed to remove it through the summer, right, before Indigenous Peoples Day. And in that process, and the idea was to remove it and keep it away from public view. In the discussions or the back and forth with the county commission, they internally agreed to move it to a Catholic church nearby and then re-erect it and put it in public view. So the Native American Indian Commission, who's been working alongside them, found out about that and fought it because, you know, they had agreed to keep it out of public view. So they haven't been completely honest with all of us. We're asking for deaccession of the statue, meaning that they remove it from their actual art collection. They're refusing to do that. They're operating as if this is a fine art piece. And that's problematic in many ways, right? Because as Native people, the majority of our art is considered, you know, folk art.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's presented in the past tense, right? Like there isn't contemporary artists producing work at this moment. So that for us, or for me, it's, you know, just feels really ugly that they're preferencing the preservation of the statue versus the preservation of a community.
Wow. And have you had meetings already with the commission, or what has the response been?
Yes. From what I know, the Native American Indian Commission has been in direct contact with the LA County Arts Commission. And I've spoken to a few of them. And there's frustration from their end because as a commission, they should feel that they have some sort of agency and power in this process, and they did. But the moment that the Arts Commission started to maneuver as if this is a fine art piece that needs to be preserved, it feels like it's disempowered a lot of folks. Even one of the council members, Mitchell Farrow, who's been pretty supportive of and I've taken lead on the internal workings within the city and county to do some of this. So we're at a standstill of what the definition of art is, or what pieces of art take precedence over an entire community, right? And Los Angeles is huge. And so they're saying that this one statue means more than an entire community. And we've introduced the concept of using the the UN Declaration of Indigenous Peoples' Rights as a piece to, like, a legal piece to use to remove the statue, you know, stating that the Arts Commission through this process is violating various articles. They used this in San Francisco as a way to reinforce the removal of the statue there, because I know there was a last minute appeal. So, you know, that's one of the tools that I think we might be able to gain some traction with.
That's good. Yeah, I was actually there in San Francisco that morning at 5 a.m. when they took down the statue, the Pioneer Monument there, mm-hmm. early days. And if you haven't for listeners, if you haven't seen that statue, Google Early Days Pioneer Monument San Francisco, and it's this horrible monument with a priest and a vaquero, like with a native man in submission, and that's been there for since the 1880s, and they finally got it taken down.
Where was it?
That was like right by City Hall, right next to City Hall in San Francisco, and they finally took it down just last month. And so that it took the Native community 30 years of organizing, so to finally get that taken down. And
we're still trying to get Klee Benali. Apparently, we're having a little difficulty. We'll do that a second. Joel, this is Paul. It's just the image of having this Indigenous Peoples Day event in a park with a big Columbus statue is kind of mind-boggling. I was curious first I don't know what the history of that statue is, but I don't know if you want to answer that. But you were mentioning covering it up, not just covering it up so people couldn't see it, but kind of keeping people away so they wouldn't do anything about it, which I can imagine if there's anger about his continued presence. And somebody wrote here, says the Los Angeles County Arts Commission continues to oppose community sentiment to remove the statue at Grand Park, but no worries. Our research shows that there are a small amount of bolts holding the statue in place that can be removed with a portable drill. Maybe the community needs to remove the Columbus statue itself. I thought that was kind of funny.
Yes, actually, in as you mentioned in the introduction, like I served as co-director for self-help graphics for a number of years. I myself am an artist, so I know the process of installing like civic art and the work that it takes, and it's not that difficult, you know. And every time you know government tries to make something seem like it's a monumental piece of work to do something very small, so we felt that we can kind of put this little guide together to. A lot of these statues across the country are constructed the same way, right? It's the cheapest materials, the cheapest type of bronze that you can find. It was done in a way that was very innovative so that they can get as many of these monuments up all over the country, right? You have all these races, and they're all produced in the same fashion. So if we figured that we do our research here and find alternatives to removing the statue, then this information can be useful across the country for folks that might not have government entities that are so willing to remove it. So we went and did our research on the statue and kind of saw what would be like, very quick and easy ways to get it done. It has these bolts on the side that kind of serve as a locking mechanism, to support the statue from falling over. So it's like a slide-in and lock mechanism. So yeah, you take out the bolts, and it takes very little effort to take it down. So it's like it isn't that difficult.
Go ahead. Yeah, I was there when I was there that morning in San Francisco. They just pulled up a flatbed truck, slid it off its pedestal, and just trucked it away. It really wasn't that hard.
And so they make it seem like it's going to take this monumental thing to remove it. And then, we've included some other, efficient ways of removing it. It is really a soft metal. So even something as easy as a concentrated pool cleaner, like the muriatic acid you can get at a Home Depot or at a Lowe's, even that kind of stuff will start eating away at it. We have to DIY this, sometimes. Open source this information so that other folks can take and be empowered by it. Even just the idea that the city knows that folks know how to take this down is a big piece of leverage that folks can use to organize around it.
So LA is, it's amazing to me that it seems like Native people and people, Taino people, have so little say in LA about what represents the city. LA has changed so much probably since that statue's gone up, or, it just, How does it feel? I mean, what was it like celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day and not having, still having that statue standing? Does it feel like the city represents, is the city fulfilling the promise that was sort of made by changing the day?
Not at all. I think they feel comfortable just with acknowledging it. I mean, on the back end, they, you know, they agree to, so you know, switch from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, but on the back end, they added in, it's also Italian American Heritage Day. So how much are they actually celebrating?
They did?
Yeah, they did, you know?
If anyone wants to listen, I did a podcast last year called Not Your Disappearing Indian, and I was on, I did one episode on the L.A. City County vote and interviewed Chrissy Castro, a Diné woman there in L.A. and an activist, and I have a lot of live footage, a live audio from the actual vote and the crazy things that people from the Italian American community had to come in and say to defend Columbus. So I was shocked. I hadn't realized that had happened, that they were also honoring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me, as an Italian American myself, who has actually participated in, well, I write sarcastic comments on some of these Italian American Facebook sites that are always very often very reactionary and again, you know, against the removal of statues and the criticizing the legacy, you know, the tainting the legacy of Columbus and all that. But you know, there is a small but important discussion within the Italian American community, and there are actually some groups, you know, progressive Italian American groups that have been standing up for, you know, for certainly since 1992. I remember it was a big thing. Italian Americans for a Multicultural United States was a group centered around in New York, and there's others. Anyway, so yeah, talk more about that. You know, the kind of, have you had personal interactions from people in the Italian American community?
Yeah, and the weird thing, LA works, well, I mean, maybe other cities work this way, but LA has a very concentrated power structure, where once you're in that system, you get to know that it's a very small world of folks who, you know, have the ear of either the board of supervisors, the mayor, the council members. And so, I mean, we know that it is in the entire Italian American community. We know that that's, you know, that as a whole, they're not opposing it. But it's this one small group of individuals that are very connected to the city through the Catholic Church. And as we know, like, there's also this huge cathedral, like a block away from this park that's erected, you know, on grounds that were, you know, where Tongva bones were found, and the Catholic Church refuses to even acknowledge that.
And Tongva are the indigenous people from the LA area.
From Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Correct. So there's some folks who have shared their experiences that even they would go, like, as a class and as a small cultural group to protest the statue. There would be these folks, you know, from these families that gifted the statue to the county, you know, there to counter protest. And, you know, at some point they shared some of the stuff that Columbus did, and in that group of folks kind of dwindled down, but the folks that remained were so adamant and so committed to, you know, kind of upholding the statue that it's gone as far as them throwing, like, coffee at children that were there to kind of protest the statue.
Wow.
So we know it's a small group. We you know, and it's not, you know, it's we're also trying to keep the conversation from maybe from, you know, the Native community versus the Italian American community, because that's not what it is.
Yeah. I think, do we have a caller on?
Yeah, we do. Well, we have James, but I would just want to introduce Clee Benally, who's also on the same line. I just want to let you all know, Joel and Clee, you're on the same line, so we're going to have to ask you specifically who we want to speak so you don't cross each other. Anyway, Clee was the lead vocalist and guitarist of a Navajo punk rock band, Blackfire, who we heard at the beginning, is also an activist, artist, silversmith, and filmmaker. I believe he had a recent documentary out, recent film. He also performs traditional Navajo dances, is actually a champion fancy war dancer. This is off Wikipedia. Anyway, Klee has been on my show at least once or twice, and is a fellow Diné with my co-host Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Klee.
Yeah, it's great to be on the show again, and good to be here with y'all having this discussion.
And you wrote an article, Uprooting Colonialism, The Limitations of Indigenous Peoples Day, which came out a year ago, and we can talk about that. But as Jackie said, we do have never mind, our first caller just dropped off. So, Klee, why don't you just jump in and talk about what's going on with you and your thoughts on in this time of Indigenous Peoples Day, ex-Columbus Day?
I feel conflicted. I feel disconnected from the larger revelry that is happening in this moment, primarily because on a local level here, at the base of the Coosliet or the Holy San Francisco Peaks, which is one of six holy mountains for Diné people that represent the pillars of our cosmology, it's central for our way of life and essential for our cultural survival. It's also a mountain that's holy to 13 indigenous nations located here in northern Arizona, just south of the Grand Canyon. It's being desecrated, and the city of Flagstaff is profiting off of this desecration and perpetuating it with a contract that they maintain to sell up to 180 million gallons of treated sewage, of wastewater from the toilet here in the city, to a ski resort on the mountain for snowmaking purposes. And so this city, just on October 2nd, passed the resolution after, in 2015, an initial proposal by a city politician who basically just wanted to do a top-down action to just jump on the bandwagon of Indigenous Peoples Day, get it passed as this sort of mark and feather, literally, in their cap to mark this day. And, you know, we stood up and we said, no, we have to reconcile the fact that there's no way we can celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day until we have some accountability regarding the extreme violation of our ways of life and the perpetuation of cultural genocide that this city has its hand in. And so we stopped the process then. I was actually part of the formation of a group that proposed a whole accountability process with public forums, meetings, and all of that. And I won't go into detail right now, but I want to get to the point is that in many ways, the celebration of Indigenous Peoples Day is extremely limited. And it's not just something that we see happening here in Flagstaff. We see that states and cities that are perpetuating anti-Indigenous violence in extreme ways, whether it's attacking homeless and unsheltered Indigenous relatives, whether it's perpetuating extreme police violence against our peoples, whether it is benefiting off of desecration of sacred places, just like Phoenix, Arizona, and its role and the expansion of Loop 202 through South Mountain and so forth, which passed Indigenous Peoples Day last year at the same time they were blasting and dynamiting through and bulldozing through South Mountain. You know, this is hypocritical of many of these cities that recognize on one level Indigenous people and jump on the bandwagon. But again, I feel conflicted and extremely disconnected from the revelry, because the reality is that the city of Flagstaff passed this resolution on October 2nd with very little outreach. They had, since 2015 up until now, 3 years to address Snowball's contract. They failed to act and cancel that contract. They failed to ensure the protection and well-being of Indigenous relatives on the street, and they failed to address the extreme racial profiling and police violence issues that we have here in this community. So, you know, I am not okay with empty gestures. I don't think anybody should, but this is what it feels like. it feels like not only just an empty gesture, but a slap and spit in the face.
Yeah, there was, I did, in my article that came out in Truth Out on Monday, on Indigenous Peoples Day, there was a lot of, I did go into the whole issue, Flagstaff, that you mentioned and quoted you about how they had not actually honored the initial processes, you know, that were the review of the MOU with the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission regarding the treatment of Diné people in Flagstaff, which is the largest, I guess you could call, border town to the Navajo Nation. And so, but, you know, I'd like to probably, you know, ask you, how could Indigenous Peoples Day be more than window dressing? You had called it window dressing when I interviewed you for that article.
Yes. I think there are many ways. And the first way is to move beyond the politics of recognition. And the politics of recognition is basically just, you know, the sort of mere acknowledgement or recognition that, you know, there are problems or that there's a bad history. But actually meaningfully reconcile the anti-Indigenous policies, actions and behaviors and attitudes that are perpetuated on systemic levels. So, you know, it's one thing to say, oh yeah, we did wrong. It's one thing to apologize, but actually to take accountability and responsibility for one's actions is what's critical. It's not a complicated equation. You know, if we just do the arithmetic, we can add that up to justice. So just merely acknowledging, and it's not even putting Band-Aids on in the case of the San Francisco Peaks. And I you know, have to clarify that, you know, the critical struggle for decades, the generation-long struggle here to protect the Holy San Francisco Peaks is not just an isolated issue that impacts 13 Indigenous nations. You know, the cases Wilson versus Block back in 1983 and Navajo Nation versus U.S. Forest Service, those cases impacted Indigenous religious freedom on a nationwide level with negative precedents. And so, you know, this is something that folks should recognize, that the city of Flagstaff has a crucial role in negatively impacting our ability to practice our religious freedom on a nationwide level as Indigenous people. So it's far-reaching implications. And here they get a pass, basically saying, okay, we did wrong, but they continue to do nothing politically to address these issues. So there needs to be a meaningful action that reconciles the wrongs that have, one, been perpetuated in the past, and two, are ongoing. And that needs to happen through consultation. It needs to happen through a free, prior, informed consent matrix, you know, that's established through the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People. It needs to happen in a way that's meaningful. That means that Indigenous people have not only a seat at the table, but that table is flipped. It's recognized that, you know, on a deep level, that this is stolen land, and reconciliation for that needs to happen on the terms of Indigenous people whose lands that were stolen and genocide continues to be perpetuated.
So we have a call. I think we have James back again, the caller.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, hey.
Hi.
Hey, you know, I really like what he's saying. You know, that's something that I've really had a problem with, too, with Indigenous Peoples Day, even though I really enjoy that, you know, we're celebrating it, is that, you know, it's just the same thing with struggles with other marginalized people, that, you know, we get a, you know, that it just kind of gives like a faux allyship and allows for a free pass, even though nothing's changed. But the one question that I want to ask is, you know, and this is coming from somebody who is, I mean, I'm not an immigrant by lineage. My family is from Guatemala in the I guess you call it the Mayan Empire, even though we're not technically like a federally recognized tribe. But how can people who fall in that area, how can we express our indigenousness and be supportive of other tribes in this time? Because that's really where I'm falling, because I don't, you know, I'm still learning about it. It took me a long time because my family identified as white for so long, and I had no idea for a long time. I knew we were, you know, Mexican, Mexico, Guatemalan, but, you know, it never really occurred to me that, hey, you know, my people are indigenous. We're just not North American. Mm-hmm. And I just want to know what I can do, because I feel kind of stranded up here, and I don't really, as I'm learning, I'd really like to get in touch with maybe some of the local tribes, but how can I do my part to help? Because I'm really interested in decolonization and, you know, putting a stop to all the violence against Native communities.
Yeah, Joel, would you like to address this? As
Sure.
Yeah.
So, I live in Los Angeles, born and raised, and so I'm not from these lands, right? These are Tongva lands. This area was, you know, the original peoples here are the Tongva, the Titavia, and the Chumash. I can say I mobilize or move in the city with a sense of privilege, in the sense that the Latinos and Chicanos make up such a, you know, vast portion of the population. So as an individual who also recognizes that I'm indigenous, you know, my family comes from a Huichol lineage, it's always reminding folks, you know, whose lands this is on. Like, so a simple land acknowledgement is one way, but that's also passive. One of the things is getting to know whose land you're actually on, connecting with those folks, like people to people, nation to nation, and finding out what is it that their interests are, and how can you make space for their voice, so that when you're speaking about their interests are, you're speaking from an informed place. So LA's weird because, or California's weird because you have a lot of tribes here who aren't federally recognized. Some of them don't want that federal recognition. Some of them do. And then you have a lot of folks in power who come from federally recognized tribes. So there's that dynamic as well, right? So even within all of that, we have to figure out how do we center on the local folks, on the Tongva, and not just in referencing them, but building their capacity to be part of this process, make informed decisions. And the Indigenous Peoples Day here in Los Angeles was an example of how you can completely invisibilize the local people by, you know, acting as a settler colonialist. We had other Indigenous folks invisibilizing the Tongva folks within this process. So those are the things you want to avoid. And it really means getting to know them, you know, person to person, participating in whatever it is that they're doing, they're mobilizing around, and using, you know, your privilege, whether it's the academy or, you know, your place of work, to push things forward.
Yeah. And Clee, would you like to talk to us? Because you often talk about how to be... what is the term you use? Not allies, but...
Accomplice, not ally.
Yeah.
Well, I wrote an essay about it. It's you can find it at indigenousaction.org, called Accomplices, Not Allies, that specifically addresses this, and I completely agree. You know, you need to articulate your relationship to indigenous people whose lands you're on, and your role can only be defined on the terms of indigenous people whose lands you're on. So by building, you know, doing that hard work, and building relationships. And a lot of times people project their politics or their political ideals onto indigenous people, you know, but we've got to recognize that we don't all have the same politics, you know, and it does take time. But if we're looking at addressing critically colonial rule and domination, and we're interested in liberating the land and the people, then we can definitely articulate a role in anti-colonial struggle, and there's a lot to be said about that. So, you know, the first step is just, you know, what was said by Joel, to articulate your relationship, but doing that on a meaningful basis, not just enough to acknowledge or recognize. You know, the difference is when we have events, we organize not just to say, oh yeah, you know, these are the people whose lands we're on, and they're not in the room, they're not meaningfully involved in the organizing. That doesn't mean anything. You know, it's a gesture, but, you know, it will be more meaningful if they're included on a very critical level in the organizing and in the room, you know, as we're moving forward in our struggles for liberation.
Yeah, and I would say that here specifically in Portland, I too am not I'm Dene Navajo from the Southwest, and that's where I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and I'm also, my father is Yankton Dakota, Yankton Sioux from South Dakota, and it's so these are not my lands where I live here in Portland, Oregon, and yet I you know, I am active in reporting and supporting the work of tribes here, of indigenous people here along the Columbia River, and I think it's always been such an honor and a privilege to get to know and be welcomed into those communities and such an affinity. I mean, I feel that I really you know, when you meet other indigenous people, you definitely feel an affinity for what they're doing, but their concerns are different, and it is a process of education even between federally recognized tribes in the United States. We are culturally very distinct. There are over, I think there are 574 federally recognized tribes now, and really, you know, there's really not a lot culturally similar between tribes here in the Pacific Northwest and tribes in the Southwest and the Great Plains. They're very distinct cultures, and so it's an education process, and we have different, sometimes different focuses, issues with the federal government.
Let me just remind people, my name's Paul Rowland. We have a little over 15 minutes left in this program, which runs until 9 o'clock every weekday morning. You can get talk radio here on KBO Community Radio with different hosts. I do Wednesday talk radio once a month on the second Wednesday with Jacqueline Keeler, who you just heard. We co-host a spot and talk about issues of concern to her and to Indigenous people. And we have on the line Joel Garcia from Los Angeles. As he said, he's identifies as a Huich. He's from a Huichol people of Mexico. And he lives in Los Angeles. He was talking about a longstanding effort both to get the Indigenous Peoples Day instead of Columbus Day, and to remove a statue of Columbus, paradoxically, on the grounds where they had the celebration of Indigenous Peoples Day. He's on the line from Los Angeles. Cleve Benally, who's a Dene, otherwise known as Navajo to most people, who is on the line with us from Arizona, I believe. And he is a musician, activist, artist, and has been talking about his own struggles. I just want to really quickly say I was once a very active Native support activist. And what I found was that what people need to do is really get to know the territory, the history, the treaties. What I found was, you scratch the surface, so to speak, and there's indigenous issues everywhere. There may not be necessarily that many people around to claim the issues, but, you know, if there's a waste dump somewhere, that was indigenous people. I knew people who are, you know, who are Kalapuya from the Willamette Valley, and they're always talking about, you know, there's a natural gas line going in, which was disturbing cemeteries, and this is stuff that, unless there's someone actually there standing up to claim the issue, there's just stuff going on everywhere that goes unrecognized. So, you know, yeah, you got to connect with the people to know what's going on, and then find out what's going on, because any action that's changing, disturbing the land is going to impact indigenous people and their issues. Anyway, we got another caller, it looks like. Barry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Paul. I just listened to Democracy Now! And the representative of the United States to the United Nations has left, and one of the reasons was looking into criminality for the United States and Israel and what they're doing, and what this has to do with what you're talking about right there is just so much so. There's a book called "Solving 9/11" by Christopher Boland.
Okay, you're getting a little afield, so we're gonna throw it to our guest.
No, but
Thank you, Barry, for calling in. We're going to throw our,
It's because of land and the Palestinians, Paul.
Okay, I understand.
Clee, could you talk to them? I mean, you yourself are have some familiarity with the issue with Israel and Palestine.
Real quick, without getting too sidetracked, I mean, we're talking about colonization and indigenous peoples. You know, it's not just a group focused in North America. You know, in this context, I mean, there are, you know, documented more than 370 some odd million indigenous people throughout the world. Arguably, everybody's indigenous to somewhere. And that's something that we need to break and maintain solidarity with indigenous people who are struggling against ongoing colonial occupation and genocide, whether it's in Palestine, whether it's in so-called South and Central America, you know, families that are forced to migrate because of U.S. imperialist policies and then face extreme violence at the border and, you know, ongoing border militarization. You know, this is a critical area where we need to have solidarity, but, you know, a lot of times people sometimes focus on these outward struggles that are very far away, whether it's sometimes even Standing Rock, you know, as close as to Standing Rock or as close to Palestine or in Chiapas, and these very, you know, critical struggles that are getting a lot of attention, but they invisibilize or they don't recognize the very critical struggles of the people whose lands are on. And, you know, that's what we sort of articulate when we say the front line is everywhere. Just know your role and explore that on a meaningful basis with the indigenous people whose lands you're occupying.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think. Would you like to add anything to that, Joel?
Sure. And you know, the issue of land use and, you know, now gentrification is like a topic everywhere, right? Which is just, you know, another form of colonization. You know, if there's anything to take from indigenous peoples and what's happening right now in Los Angeles is what are we doing to empower the local folks to have agency over land use here in LA? Hmm. That's an indication that we're doing absolutely nothing as a city, as a county, to do that. We have the LA River Project, and there's no, like, there isn't any process for Native folks to, you know, have a say in it. There's been some advocacy there, but very little. But how do we, you know, that issue of land use that Clee articulated and the connection to the land, without any of that, you know, any proclamation, any statute removal really means nothing. If at the end of the day we're still under the rule of you know, U.S. imperialism.
Well, I often feel like what's been really revealed from the past, you know, I guess, yes, the Trump administration and everything that's been going on the national scene, even Kavanaugh, the Kavanaugh confirmation, is the real nature of the country, the so-called country we live in, which is fundamentally and apparently unapologetically, you know, misogynistic and colonialistic, imperialistic, and is, you know, you see at the national level them reasserting that, you know, the senators and I think that often the reason why we are, it's often comes down to political recognition. That's why Native people focus so much on sovereignty. That when a nation, when a people have political recognition and those political boundaries are strong, then they are better able to protect themselves physically, also culturally, and their language. And when those boundaries are weak, then they are more likely to be assimilated or to have their languages outlawed and their histories dismissed. I think that, and that's why I find the Flagstaff, what you're doing there, Clee, really interesting, because you're getting the city of Flagstaff to engage the Navajo Nation politically with addressing, you know, direct the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission, and then with what you're doing, Joel, in LA, you know, it's very interesting because one of the big issues, and this actually came up in the civil rights movement. My grandmother's cousin, Vine Deloria Jr., wrote this book called Custer Died for Your Sins in 1968. And he talked a bit about how the National Congress of American Indians, what their view was on what the Black civil rights movement leaders were asking for. And they had issues. They what they were fighting for was not civil rights. They were fighting for sovereignty, which would be, and they weren't seeking equality in this society. They were seeking the political recognition of their own nations, and they felt that they felt that only Black nationalism. He has this whole chapter where he talks about that, how they felt like to Indian leaders only Black nationalism made sense, because that was the only way you could really protect yourself, would have strong political boundaries. And with everything we've seen since those years, since the 60s, and we're seeing where we are nationally, where we see that this is a government run for by white men and their white female helpmeets, you know, I mean, it really does call into question, like, is there any other answer besides political strength and some sort of national, I guess, what do you think of that?
Who are you asking?
I guess either of you guys.
Klee?
Sure. I mean, I just want to sort of, and maybe answer this and leave with a statement. It's just that, you know, if the state dismantles these statues and proclaims Indigenous Peoples Day, what do we actually achieve if the structures and systems rooted in colonial violence remain intact? You know, is this mere political posturing and as we mentioned earlier, window dressing? And how does that diminish actual liberatory agitations? You know, we're talking about power here. You know, when we talk about recognition on the political level, we're talking about power. You know, so how do we benefit from whitewashing ongoing colonial legacies? You know, I'm all for removing colonial symbols and nationalistic myths, so long as the structures such as colonialism, racism, white supremacy, heteropatriarchy go along with them. You know, it's been argued that Indigenous Peoples Day is a step in the right direction, but, you know, we have to ask what direction and what are actually the next steps. You know, at a minimum, we should be negotiating politically, you know, and engaging on a level with power and setting the demands, setting conditions for these cities, for these states. But we don't see that happening. I just see celebrations. And if we truly desire to liberate our lands and our people, on our ancestors in the coming generations, we need to go deeper than that. You know, because colonialism is not a static event, but a structure built on ideas, and the ideas that you're talking about, you know, that are represented in the problems we see in this community through heteropatriarchy, rape culture, in the way that women are treated and viewed, and two-spirit, you know, folks are treated and viewed in this day and age. You know, if we understand that colonization has been war, then why are we fighting a battle for recognition and affirmation through these power structures? You know, we have so much more, and we can go deeper. And that's, you know, I'm not against Indigenous Peoples Day at all. I'm against, you know, superficial gestures handed down from politicians that are, you know, what could be symbolic acts of pacification. Hmm. You know, if we really want to build movements and make demands for liberation of land and people, then we have to do that on our terms and go much deeper.
Yeah. And what do you think, Joel?
Yeah, even with something simple as the removal of the statue here at Grand Park, we're asking for a power shift. You know, the Arts Commission it has become that obstacle. And within that commission of, I think, 12 or 14 folks, there's not one person who claims or identifies as Indigenous. And then, you know, the folks in charge of the Civic Art Department also are coming from a very white perspective. So our ask to the city and the county is to establish a decolonial re-indigenizing committee to take this on, to figure out what communal process is gonna look like, who decides what, because they're already deciding, okay, well, we'll remove the statue, we'll erect something for the Tongva folks, we'll do these educational programs and these outreach efforts. So everything's already being predetermined for us, and we're saying, like, no, you don't get to decide that. You know, we get to decide that in whatever way we feel is appropriate. So that's one of the power shifts that we want to make within the Arts Commission, is like, there's no funding stream for Native artists here in LA. Wow. And if there's anything, you know, if there's anything for Native artists, it's for federally recognized artists. So that leaves out most of California Indians from even being able to participate in those funding streams. So we're asking for a complete power shift even within that. So that, you know, we can have a say over what our public spaces look like here, how you know, Native artists are supported. And so it's that power shift that Klee is talking about, that if that doesn't happen, then it's all for nothing.
Thank you. Yeah, so I think we're almost at time, but I really wanted to thank you both for coming on the show and the work that you're both doing in your communities. And you know, it's there has to that power shift. That it's obviously it's a battle that obviously they're taking very seriously. You know, you see all these old white men up there, you know, acting all tough and threatening to sue, you know, women who come forward with accusations of sexual assault, and certainly they act the same way towards us when we make mm-hmm. demands, and certainly termination is something that the Trump administration is definitely on the table, and with you know Zinke saying that he wants to turn he knows lots of tribes that would be happy to give up their sovereignty to become corporations. And we saw, you know, a tribe recently being told it's not a tribe Indian people anymore, the Mashteca Pequot. And then with the recent ruling on ICWA in Texas by a federal judge finding it unconstitutional because it's race-based and in violation of the 14th Amendment.
Indian Child Welfare Act.
Yes, ICWA. Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA. Yeah. And so all these attacks that they are actively using the system that they've constructed, the colonial system, on us. And how do we, change has to happen at a level that I feel like when you look at countries that were able to assert themselves, it always came through strong political boundaries. Whether you're talking about Ireland freeing itself from English colonization, or even the establishment of Israel, which has had so much support politically, and the diminishment of political recognition of the Palestinian people, you know, it always comes down to political, respect.
Also, I'd like to thank you both too. We got to go, and thank you, Jacqueline. Mm-hmm. And this is Paul Rowland with the Wednesday Talk Radio. I don't yet have a guest for next week, but October 24th, in 2 weeks, I will have Norman Solomon, the former Portland activist. I think he himself is in the LA area. Anyway, thank you, Tammy, for stepping in and engineering this morning. And we got to run. Stay tuned, KBOO.
Is not indiscriminate. Gender, skin, color, class, or sexual preference are struggling.